You're listening to a podcast from 702.
But it's time for another fun conversation and also serious conversation. It's the Across the Desk feature. We do this every single Thursday between 11 and 12 o'clock. And I bring in interesting people to come and talk about whatever they want to talk about, really. And today, I'm so excited that I have Pontso Pilane, who is a journalist and media trainer. Hello, Pontso.
Hi, Clement. How are you?
I'm good. And I also have Babalo Chaoke, who's the Oxford University graduate and social activist. Hey, Babalo, how's it?
Hey, Clement. How are you?
I'm all right. Thank you guys for making time to come and be across the desk with me for this hour.
Thank you so much for the invitation.
So, look, there's so many things to discuss, and I don't think we're going to get through all the topics because all of them are so interesting, and I know the listeners are going to be relating to all of them and call about their experiences as well. But I want to talk about maybe, Pontso, let's start with, and Babalo, maybe you can start it off, in fact, because you also suggested this topic, the politics of food and food insecurity. Just expand on why you wanted to talk about that.
Okay, sure. Good morning to your listeners, first of all. So I've always thought that food is political. I always wonder why the Jabu Hobe, why are we eating pap, why do we eat chicken feet and tap? This is for Black South Africans in particular. Is it our culture or is it out of need? And I've always, as someone who comes from a home that was food insecure for a while, where we literally scraped for food.
Yeah.
Pap was a staple. It was a main item that I ate. And now that I'm working and I'm able to afford quinoa and couscous, I don't eat pap now.
No, just pap.
Once every 2 years, I'll eat pap just to remember my poverty.
Yeah.
But for me, I associate pap with poverty because it was out of need that I ate pap because it doesn't have a lot of nutrition, right?
Yeah.
So I started reading up on food insecurity and how in some countries like China, people started eating dogs in the 1950s when Mao Zedong was the president, because obviously there was a famine that took place there, and people started eating dogs out of need. But now they have festivals where they celebrate in union and stuff like that, where they celebrate eating dogs as part of their culture. And I've always said there's politics of food, and we should always be aware that people don't eat food because they want to. Sometimes it's out of necessity.
Oh, it is. And, you know, in fact, one trigger, Babalo, because I grew up and I was telling, you know, I had gone to see my aunt this past weekend, and I was telling my aunt that, yo, I keep at Lubona pap because I grew up eating pap every single day. Not because we loved and enjoyed pap, but because, I mean, we didn't have any other option. And my aunt was laughing at me because I said we would normally have rice, testic, and mama would hit you if you dare cook testic rice on a Monday or Wednesday because you have to cook it only on a Sunday. And we only had semp probably like once in 6 months. But that pap thing was, we didn't have a choice. Like literally, that was what was there. Pontso, was that your experience as well? Or did you grow up with couscous?
You know what? I need to just declare that I am a pap lover.
Okay.
Listening to people who have triggering stories and traumatic experiences about pap is quite shocking to me. I love me some pap. I would eat pap every single day if I could. But, you know, of course, we all grew up eating pap. It was a staple in my household as well. The one thing I can't stand now, what, like, for me is, like, a sign of poverty and, like, when things were bad at home is beef, Bull Brand. I cannot.
Oh, I remember Bull Brand.
I want to cry, you know. Yeah. So I do understand the association with certain food. Oh, what's this? The powdery thing that you're supposed to mix with water, with milk.
Movite.
Sometimes mix. Movite. Oh,
yo, again, yeah, get it.
We used to call it, my mom used to call it pudamand. Like drink power, like, you know, because it's carbs essentially. I cannot stand it. So, you know, I do understand kind of like, you know, like that, like what you and Babalo are talking about around, we have certain food that triggers us, that takes us back to when things were bad at home and those situations. So I totally get it. But what I find fascinating about pap is that, you know, the maize meal pap is the most popular pap in South Africa. But maize is not even like actually South African, you know. Whereas sorghum, like I'm in Tswana, right? So our staple, gemabele, or tin, as we call it, you know, sorghum pap. But that's not the staple in South Africa. So it's always shocking to me, Hore, yes, our staple, like, or the sign of our, like, a lot of black households have a rate, their sign of eating staples is pap, but it's the maize meal, whereas sorghum has been around for centuries and centuries, and it didn't come on a boat, but that's not the staple in South Africa. I find that incredibly fascinating.
Yeah. Babalo, isn't it weird that we also call these kind of foods traditional food? Like when you're having pap kamautwana with chicken feet, you know, people say, oh, I miss traditional food. And especially, yeah, you know, people coming from even the villages, the townships, and they get to Joburg and they're like, oh, you know, I miss traditional food. I want to go to Shisanyama and have this and that. But isn't it just food? Why are we calling it traditional food?
I think, obviously, it comes from during the struggle days, like colonialism and apartheid, where the barge afal in Afrikaans, throw away food. So, like, intestines, like trout, for instance. A lot of people get offended when I say this. I'm like, it's not as though black people were saying, oh, yeah, let me eat trout because this is amazing. Obviously, I'm not going to let that. People who enjoy the taste. But at times, I ask people, ask yourself, why? Because you couldn't afford to buy a whole cow, or you couldn't afford to buy steak, or, like, you know what I mean? The only thing that you could afford to get, which obviously butcheries were throwing away, or your buses. I'm now thinking about people who used to work in factories as domestic workers. Their bosses would give them the throwaway part of the food, and obviously it became tradition that as black people, our mothers used to cook that for us, and we associated with that as tradition and culture. And for me, I'm like, it's not our culture. I actually want to challenge that and say it's not our culture. It was because Nereso Gola, we were struggling, and we didn't have food, that we actually now made it into an okay thing.
Yeah, and because, so I've been doing this cooking thing, you know, the producers are trying to get me to learn how to cook so I can host some kind of a Christmas lunch or whatever and go head to head with Bongani. And now my cooking has always been, you know, pap growing up, because I'm the firstborn, pap ka chicken, and you cook it in the most traditional sense, you know, kametsi, and onion, and that's it, really. And then you really depend on sopo that comes, you know, king sopo ka sehoa. What is sopo?
Gravy.
That gravy that comes, you know, out of at the end of the product. And then yes, 2 days ago, I actually, as part of the assignment on this cooking with Clement thing, I was supposed to make butternut soup, and I made butternut soup, but it looked like, and there was a term that I heard this morning, like a puree, right? And then now I thought, so I made it thick. And I thought that's how it's supposed to be. And then when I spoke to Bongani this morning, I said to Bongani, oh, Bongani, I sent Bongani a picture last night. And Bongani said, oh, I saw you had a puree and chicken fillet. But I said to, no, it wasn't that. It was a butternut soup and chicken. But then soup is soup and it's watery. But that goes to show how we're not used to these kind of foods. And I would call that fancy food. But food is really is food. Ponto, what's your view on that? Like people calling some foods traditional food and some foods are either fancy food or they just fall under the category of normal food.
No, I mean, that's true, right? Like, there's a lot of, like, what Babalo was saying around offals, mukhodu, dikakotakana, eating trotters. Those are results of colonialism, right? Like, we eat that food because those were the parts of the animal, like, let's say, a cow or a sheep that were left for black people during those times. So it's quite funny that became our traditional food when we think about it that way. Even like the fact that, you know, maize. But when we look for, like, we call it traditional food because we had to adapt. We had to adapt to colonialism and we had to make it work. But for now, what I really find interesting is that, you know, there's a lot of, like, food is very political. I think I was having a conversation with a few friends of mine a couple of weeks ago, and one of them mentioned that she really gets offended when people call certain food, they say, like, it's disgusting, you know? Yeah. You know, people, like, for example, one that is quite common, particularly in South Africa, is Batu, like, saying that masonja, which is mopani worms.
Yeah.
The other word for it is a disgusting. Like, how do you?
How I mean,
people's food.
Yeah, disgusting. And I mean, masonja are actually the best thing I've had. I mean, take a listen to this.
Hi, Clement. Interesting topic with your guest. I also wanted to know, how did it come about that people started eating masonja? Was it because there was no other food that they can eat? There was no meat, there was no birds that they can maybe slaughter or something. How did it come about? And it's called traditional food. I mean, guys, have you seen this thing when it's still alive? It must have been that there was no other food. Then these guys or whoever decided to taste these animals. Sipo here in Midrand.
Sipo, thank you for that. Guys, I mean, Sipo is asking, how did people come about it, Babalo? I mean, why? On one hand, I'm thinking, okay, you know, maybe people were creative to understand the, and I say this cautiously, the nutritional benefits of certain, you know, certain foods. But on the other hand, I'm thinking, guys, as a black people, we also struggled, hey? Like, we had to make do and find what we can and survive. Like, literally, our lives, especially from the beginning, have always been about survival.
Yeah.
That's true. I mean, if you look at everything. I mean, who eats, like, look at Bull Brand, right? Like, I'm not saying, like, I'm not knocking anyone or, like, belittling anyone who enjoys it, but the idea of Bull Brand and like just those parts, like just mixed together, you know, also just thinking about like just the way food is sold as well, and what kind of food is sold, and particularly what black people consider some of their staples is directly linked to the level sometimes of where we were in society at that time
at
and
time.
What we could afford. And so now I'll never say to somebody, like, my mother once in a while makes Bull Brand, and I'm just like, yo, I can't eat it, thank you. And not in a way of I can't eat it because I think it's below me, but it, like what we always say, it triggers me because it reminds me of this. So there's a way that you can't, like, it's about how we communicate why we don't like certain food and not make it a classist thing as well.
Yeah, Babalo?
So just to, I have a few things to say, and I hope I can summarize them quickly without taking time. So just
quickly,
when Clemente, and I think you are saying what's a group with Pito Mboweni in terms of being able to cook.
No, that's true.
I don't see his chicken on Twitter. That was terrible and embarrassing. So I think he also needs to learn how to cook like you. But just for 2 points, it's interesting as well that for Rona in my home, Bull Brand was actually, we ate it like once a week because we couldn't afford anything. So Monday to Friday, it was like chicken feet and cabbage and whatnot. And once a week, then we'd have Bull Brand. So it was actually a special day when you had Bull Brand. So even in your poverty, you were privileged. To respond to Sipo about masonja, I think we need to be very careful in how we speak and ask certain questions as well. Because, I mean, as I said, food is very political, but you might also see a lot of tribalism coming in, because who eats masonja? It's usually people in Limpopo, Venda and Tsonga people. And when we speak about them and we say they're eating dirty foods, also, like, speaking of them as the bottom of the totem pole people as well, like, we say they're disgusting, they're dirty, they're weird. And it's a similar thing in terms of how the world right now is angry at China, because with the whole pandemic going on, the source of, apparently, obviously, scientifically as well, the source of this disease is a bat that was eaten by someone in an animal market, whatever. So there was a wild animal that was eaten that caused this whole pandemic. So it's like, some people have been saying very racist and problematic things about China. And it's like, everybody can be problematized in what they eat. Who says caviar is classy? Who decides a salmon or, what is it, a fish or beef or chicken? Like, vegans can challenge all of us and say, why are we eating meat? Why are we eating chicken? Yeah. And you know what I mean? Like, so I think we should be very careful not to offend and have systems of, like, oppression seep into a conversation about how food is political.
Yeah.
We can easily be tribalistic.
Yeah, all right. I'm taking calls on 011-883-0702. So many of our listeners want to join in this conversation. I'm also seeing voice note on 072-702-1702. Francis, you're in Bryanston. Hi. Hey, Francis. Francis. Okay. Francis, we'll come back to you. Peter, you're in Pretoria. Hello.
Hello. Hi, Kevin. Thank you so much for taking my call.
Yeah, sure.
For me, food is a very important thing in our lives. And how we understand it and how we approach it, I think what the gentleman says, that it is something political. I tend to agree with what he's saying.
Mm-hmm.
Because there is, like any other production or something that you can think of that has to do with capitalism, food is very key in that. But I think why do we eat, should we ask ourselves first? Because there may be two reasons. Is it to nourish our bodies or just to fill our hunger pangs? And I would say, you spoke about, let me start with the pap thing. If you talk about pap, for instance, that is just to fill yourself. It doesn't contribute any nutrition. It has no nutritional value. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And then, let me give you a good example. If you buy a car, Clement, that car comes with a thing, what do you call this book that you get with your car? Your how you should look after your car.
Mm.
And with our bodies, it is the same thing, you know. So if you don't follow that manual, and you've got a petrol car and you just put in diesel, it's going to, it won't last you long.
Mm, so you're making that then in correlation to our bodies as well, and how we need to eat nutritious food so that, you know, we are also healthy. Frances, you're in Bryanston. Hi.
Hello.
Hi, Frances. Go ahead.
Yes. Well, I'm listening to my pony words and I'm smiling because prawns are the cockroach of the ocean.
Mm-hmm.
And then we don't, and people pay a lot of money to eat them. So it all has to do with perception.
Mm.
Mm. So if you like your food, I mean, my grandchildren, they had to learn to like prawns.
Yeah.
It's an acquired taste. So I think it's the same with the pony words. I haven't eaten them, but I'm sure it's an acquired taste. So I don't know why people think it's a class thing.
And then they call it, you know, it's exotic, it's expensive because what? It's prawns. And I also have an SMS from Tennyson. In fact, it's a WhatsApp text message. Tennyson says, Sipo is allowed to be ignorant. I'm sure he finds the sea cockroaches / prawns attractive. Nothing traditional about food, and mealy-meal is not an African staple. So, guys, why then do we look at certain foods? And, I mean, yes, Babalu, you speak about the politics of food. And I'm just wondering here, is it because, you know, people look at things like masonja, mopani worms as disgusting because there's an association between the food and the people that discovered that and have acquired the taste and are enjoying that. Is there a correlation there? Is that why then you find it disgusting as opposed to prawns and the group of people that would traditionally and historically would have started eating prawns, and how then that's seen as exotic and it's also expensive and it's not looked at as disgusting?
Yeah. So I think I'm thinking about Boudreau, who wrote a paper or book about taste and how the upper class try and distinguish themselves from the working class, from the poor people. Mm. So to say, like, if they decide that theater is upper class taste, then obviously anyone who goes to theater is seen as cultured and learned and rich and whatnot. And I believe that if Italians or English people decided that masonja tomorrow are cuisine, everybody is going to be buying
masonja. And it's going to be expensive.
400 rand.
Yeah.
They're going to put a stamp of whiteness on it. So, like, I guess, again, it's about class, it's about race, and it's about history as well. So, I mean, as I've said before, it's very political. So, there are foods that have been gentrified by white people in South America. Like, quinoa was a staple. Yama South Americans, Latin America was eating that for years and years. And only when white people came in and said, oh, you know, let's gentrify this food, it now became this la-di-da food. So I think obviously it has to do with who decides what is disgusting and what is upper class.
Yeah. Yeah, certainly, certainly agree with that. I remember seeing a picture actually of Malana, the intestines.
And my favorite.
They looked, yo, Ponzo, they looked so nice, ne? But then they called them something else and they were going for about 600 rand. And I was so surprised, wow. But it was like a very expensive restaurant. I remember, I don't remember the name of the restaurant, but they were serving that and it was going for about 600 rand. And they didn't call it Malana as we know and have been eating them.
Are
they
the called?
Yes, yes, tubes. Something tubes. They call them something tubes. And then, and I was like, but guys, give Malana. Come on. And because now you have adapted this, now it becomes this fancy thing, you know, that also comes at this high price, Ponzo. So do you agree then with Paballo that, you know, should Italians adapt that, the next day we would be buying Malana and chicken feet for 1,000 rand?
I think what we're seeing is a lot of trends, particularly in the food and kind of like that sector, right? Mm. And we can attribute it, when I do my research and when I just read, it's two things. There's a lot of diet culture that's involved in what we're eating. The first caller was talking about how do we eat for pleasure or do we eat to nourish our bodies? I think we eat for both, right? That's, of course, we eat because we need the energy, but we also eat because food is nice. It's delicious.
Yeah.
It's delicious, you know. And so finding a balance between the two. But when we look at also the kind of economic or the political setting or context of eating certain food or promoting certain food over the other, we look at, as Babalu was mentioning, Kina, which is from the Americans and South America in particular. And we look at what kind of the diet culture mentality and also the superfood, vegan, / eating clean, / it's a wellness diet, like it's called many different things depending on the circles that you roll in. What it's done to things like increase the vulnerability of quinoa farmers in Bolivia and make it more expensive and make it, it's been a sustainable food for so long. So the people now who live in Bolivia cannot even afford to buy their own staple food because we are, the global market wants it because we're eating healthy, we're eating clean. And so we cannot talk about the politics of food and separate the politics of food from diet culture and what diet culture has created, which is the system where we're always policing our body size, we're always policing what we eat, and also forgetting that we're all in this machinery of capitalism, right? Like, we are all trying to be, like, we're in this race that will never win. We're literally spinning on a wheel, and we think we're going to win. So we really need to be conscious of what the things that we do, what we eat, and how we eat certain things affects the politics of everyone else and the circumstances of everyone else.
Yeah, certainly. I want to take some news headlines, guys, and we'll continue our conversation after this.
Clement Mangatela. No. Live. Transform. This is 702.
Someone asked me on the on Twitter, is Azania gonna come today, Clement?
You see
the reputation you've created.
No. Yeah. If I had to tell you what was going on Monday and Tuesday, you would absolutely have sympathy.
I would. You did say something, really get it. I understand. Mm. What's your favorite? And I say that is in inverted commas, traditional food. Have you also wandered around these politics of food conversations?
Yes, food, but of the indigenous people.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, Tseho's partner has a side hustle and she sells the best, freshest tribe. So sometimes I would get the whole from her and just the whole weekend, that's what we're on. I mean, from the liver, just put that liver on the fire and then mokodua thing, you start cooking it. It's, so
and
that's
it's food.
My favorite.
It's not traditional food.
Yes.
Or indigenous food.
It's food.
Yes.
It's food. What's yours?
You
look like a tombolo.
I used to eat chicken feet when I was growing up a lot, so I don't touch those anymore. They disgust me because I ate
them.
I ate them too much. So now I enjoy Malana. I enjoy Malana, and I enjoy livers. So those are my
There's a lady where the school that I used to go to, Koroma, and she used to sell chicken feet in a plastic. So we'd rush to the fence to buy because hers was the best, and it ran out quickly. So I've got fond memories. Unlike you, didn't overdo. I would like to still do it. Yeah, it was lovely. One of my favorite things from growing up.
Clement Manyathela on 702.
20 minutes before 12 o'clock. Look, I know a lot of you still want to talk about the issue around food politics, but I want to move to the second topic because it's just as equally important. And I still have Pontso Pilane, who's a journalist and media trainer. I also have Babalo Chauke, Oxford University graduate and social activist. I want us now, guys, to talk about domestic workers. And Babalo, I want you to start it off because your mother was, and I'm not sure if she still is, a domestic worker. And when I spoke to Bongani this morning, I mentioned the healing from, and I don't want to call it anger, but I want to call it, you know, because when your mother leaves you and you have to now fend for yourself, so you have to cook, you have to look after the siblings, you have to you know, wash your other siblings, go to school, come back and cook, because your mother is looking after other people's children. There's a level of pain and I suppose for some people trauma that's associated with that. Tell me about your experience. You've been very passionate about this. I read your opinion piece as well the other day on this subject.
Okay. Yeah, so I wrote an opinion piece for Thought Leader. The title is An Ode to Kitchen Girls. And one of the arguments that I made there was the nomenclature that people want to give to our mothers. So my mom is still a domestic worker, but right now she's working part-time because obviously she's sickly. She's in her 50s, on her arthritis, so she can't like work full-time. But she's still a domestic worker, and she's been since I was like 6 years old. Mm-hmm. So all my life, my mom has been a domestic worker, and my interaction with whiteness, or first time interacting with white people, was through my mom's madam and boss.
Yeah, Babalo, I'm going to ask you to please put the phone next to your mouth. We're just really struggling to hear you. Yeah, it's much better now. Yeah, go ahead.
So I was explaining that my interaction with whiteness at first was through them being my mom's bosses.
Yeah.
And it obviously, as you say, there's a lot of issues around that. And I think one of the issues that I wanted to mention as well in my article was that women are not empowered equally. So, for instance, it's Women's Month now. It's drawn to a close. And most people that were my mom's bosses were women who were CEOs, who were managers, who were teachers, et cetera, et cetera. And they mistreated her. So my argument is how, or rather my thoughts around domestic work is that women need to also have a talk amongst themselves about how feminism empowers some women and disempowers others.
Ponso, the reality here when we talk about domestic work, you know, is that, you know, the workers often face many unheard, unseen and unspoken challenges, you know, and to an extent even human rights violations, you know. And I'm not sure if this is a conversation that we often speak about. And when I read the article that Babalo wrote, I realized that, you know, many of these domestic workers are unable to express how they feel about even their working environments. And that's why, you know, Babalo would then express the mother's experience through this opinion piece. But Babalo raises an important point there, that the issue around empowerment and the issue around treatment of these domestic workers.
No, I mean, it is such a big topic. And I think we cannot talk about, you know, domestic work and not talk about the expectation that's involved, you know. So, for instance, you know, some people don't want to call it domestic workers. They want to call them helpers, you know. And there's been a lot of kind of people who've advocated, even domestic workers themselves, because they, you know, they've unionized through different unions, such as the South African Domestic Worker Labor Union. And like what we see is that it's not valued, right? And it's because, Clement, we come from a society, it's because when something's done by women because of patriarchy, we don't value it, right? So if you think about outside of domestic work, it's not valued, like doing domestic work is not valued. So then it's being done by women in a society that has a history of that domestic work was done because by a certain class of women, by a certain race of women, and what that means for us. Actually, one of the most interesting books I read was Like Family, which is basically a book by Inna Janssen about domestic workers, the history of domestic workers in South Africa. I'd suggest people read that book. It's really interesting. And it talks just about the complexities of that. My mother is not a domestic worker, but my grandmothers, both my grandmothers were. Mm. And, you know, just talking to them about that history of leaving your children and not being there, and the complication of what it did to generations of families. Mm-hmm. Our mothers left their children to go raise other people's children. We saw just last week the story of Mekabunina, who was beaten up by a child that she raised because she was a black woman who's helpless, or who in that dynamic she doesn't have the power in that relationship. And so these are the situations that a lot of domestic workers find themselves.
You know, and Pabalo, the reality about this is that this is across races and classes, right? This mistreatment and the bad working conditions, the discrimination. It's not specifically when, you know, a mother works for a white family, for instance. But what we have seen is that even some people who talk about women empowerment, some people who are Pan-Africanist, when they go back home and you see how they treat their domestic workers, you will be shocked.
Totally. I think obviously it's also a class thing, right? That most black or Indian and colored people who also have domestic workers mistreat the what they want to call helpers, which also I have a problem with. Like, what's wrong with calling someone a domestic worker? Because whether you call them a helper or a domestic worker, you're still mistreating them, you're still abusing them. And as Poncho was saying, the fact that Mark Habonina, and obviously that's one case that we saw in the news. And in most cases, we hardly hear these stories. Some of them actually die at the hands of their bosses. So I think the mistreatment transcends all races, because my mom, is obviously for now, I'm speaking from a very personal experience, and I'm aware that some people obviously wanted to be far removed from me, but for me, it's something that affected me personally. So I used to go to my mom's bosses with her, and as you're saying, it wasn't a thing of it was just white people. So it's not a race thing only, although race is a factor. It's a class thing, I think.
I want us to, in fact, let me play this voice note on 072-702-1702, because I want us to speak more also about the title, because there are people that think, you know, calling them helpers is a politically correct term, but I want you to argue why that is problematic.
Always wondered, guys, like, I was the kid that my mom took with her when she went to work, and I grew up in her domestic quarter with her. But my sister, on the other hand, was the kid that was left behind, particularly my grandmother, and I low-key, it's very evident that she has, like, resentment issues, do you call it that, with my mom. They don't, yeah, I think it scarred her. I don't even know how to explain it.
I hear that, and I suppose it speaks to that bitterness, Pabalo. Hey, how do you ever heal from that? When, and I know, because your mother didn't just deliberately choose to leave the kids at home and go take care of the other family. I mean, she had to do it for survival. But as this voice note says, there's a level of bitterness, because you just, you know, you think, you know, she was there, you know, taking care of other people's children while we were stuck at home. And while she was doing that, there's also that level of mistreatment as well that comes with it.
Yeah, and I don't think people consider or even ask themselves, who does the domestic work of the domestic worker, or who looks after the children of the nanny? Because these women, and it's a very tough one, because obviously I want women to be CEOs. I want women to be in the boardroom, right? But they're leaving another woman to look after their children. And who looks after the children of the of the mother that's looking after their child? You know what I mean? So there's that gap. And I think obviously you do unpack the bitterness, or you get over it at some point through therapy and unpacking as you go along in your life. But I think for me, I just wanted to make the country aware, because it's still very, I mean, 2 million women in South Africa are domestic workers today, and most of them are black and poor. And I think it's something that is affecting us as a country that needs to be spoken about more regularly.
Yeah. Fonso, what are your views on the people that think, you know, calling domestic workers helpers, that's a politically correct term? Because Fonso has argued also even previously in that article that this term needs to be, you know, problematized, because it removes the profession and the professional relationships, and seems to suggest that these women are only there to assist or help.
I totally agree with that. You know, the reason, you know, people want to use the word helper to, like, sometimes unintentionally, so that they don't sound to be politically correct. But when we use that word, you know, words mean things. And as journalists and as people who work with words, we know how loaded words are. When you say helper, do you pay somebody who helps you? You don't, right? Because I'm helping you. Helping is a voluntary thing. So when you call somebody who's supposed to be an employee, who in particularly South Africa is an employee and has certain rights as an employee, and you as an employer have certain responsibilities, when you call them a helper, aren't you not minimizing those responsibilities and those rights?
Mm.
You know, it's such a small thing, you know, and we see it the topic that has come up on Twitter in person and so many times when people are like, you know, when you talk about the class relations, you know, when you talk about black women being madams or black families being madams or the employer in that case to other black women, and you talk about the exploitation where people are saying, no, I work, my job I require, so I pay her what I like, what I can afford. Right. Imagine, would you take that as an excuse at your job that we don't have money, but we're going to pay you what we can. And so these are the small things that play a part in the diminishing of what domestic work is, and that feeds into how then domestic workers get exploited.
Yeah.
Right. So, like, imagine, for instance, why are people okay with, and I know I might offend a few people, with a domestic worker living in their house.
Mm.
You know, like for me, and this is a personal choice, I've made a choice that at any point, if I ever have children and I need a full-time nanny or, you know, to employ someone to help me within the domestic work in my house, I have to be living in a house where if I want them to be live in, they have their own low quarters, or that they will come in and they'll have a 9-to-5 or maybe let's say a 7-to-3 because I feel like that is what is required. We need to professionalize and see domestic work as proper work, and that is how we are going to
see
the exploitation of domestic workers
and have the consideration for their lives as well. I mean, you know, sometimes when you've got domestic workers, you think literally their lives and their sole responsibility in life is to protect, I mean, it's to take care of you and your family. But these people have kids, they've got lives out there. And as you say, you know, the names and the labels are very important. You know, it's important to use the correct terms, because that comes with how you treat them, the remuneration, the benefits. And, you know, one thing that I looked at, Babalo, in your article was you said something like, imagine a secretary or an accountant being called a helper. And I just thought, how do we then balance the need for correct terminology when you refer to domestic workers with the need to be cautious not to romanticize this profession? Because, I mean, people don't do it. Many people don't do it because, I want to be a domestic worker when I grow up, or because it's a great profession. No, like many people are doing it because they are desperate. They're doing it because they need to earn a living.
Yeah. I think it's a very dehumanizing work and profession, to be honest, in many ways, right? And I think for me, it's very weird when people are getting, or rather bizarre, that people are weird about the terminology but not about the treatment that's behind the name. So for me, ask, firstly, I wasn't speaking for all domestic workers. There are 2 million women that are domestic workers in this country. I don't speak for them. I think it's better to ask when Maria comes in or when Nonkansa comes in and says, I'm looking for a job, I want to be a domestic worker. Ask them, what do you want to be called? Because also now, going back to something that Ponto alluded to in her comment about having a domestic worker live in your house, and this is what black people do mostly, where they start calling them ma or aunt. You are being manipulative and exploitative using responsibility politics that are linked to culture. She's not your mother. Yes. You don't have to pay family. Like, if I'm sorry, there are things that I have to do, or rather that I can do.
But auntie.
Not, because my thing is, what you're going to do then is, I don't have to pay my aunt. I mean, if my aunt visits me in Cape Town, in my house, and cleans, I got aunties doing me a favor. Mama, if she comes and washes dishes in my house, she's my actual biological mother. But
she's
domestic workers. She's not your gogo. Call her a domestic worker. Call her by her name, or rather ask her what they prefer to be called. Ask them. Let women speak for themselves.
That is so important. Ponto, what do you want to say about that?
I absolutely agree, you know, and we hide behind the respectability of cultural respectability and all those kinds, as Pavala said, to exploit people, you know, and I just feel like, you know, we as black people as well, we need to have a real conversation around how we treat domestic workers or we treat the help in inverted comments, you know, and as well as think about what it means for us to, if we are really committed to dismantling oppressive systems that existed and how we contribute to these oppressive systems, and think for yourself, you know, I remember like because of South Africa's deep levels of inequity, that's why we have such a flourishing, you know, domestic worker sector. It's great, you know, women are employed, people can put food on the table, but it cannot come at the cost of people's dignity and people we experience.
Yeah, that's very important. Guys, thank you so much. Unfortunately, we're out of time. I could talk to you guys for hours. Ponto Pilani, journalist and media trainer, and Babalo Chauke, Oxford University graduate and a social activist. I really enjoyed this conversation. Thank you guys for coming through.